this week's program, we speak with writer Sharon White. The Temple Professor's latest book, Vanished Gardens, Finding Nature in Philadelphia, is published this month. In the first of two reports, David Patrick Stearns examines the history of Leonard Bernstein's Candide. A production at the Arden Theatre in Philadelphia opens this week. And Jason Pfeiffer explores the rich history of Philadelphia's Walnut Street Theatre, which is now in its 200th season. That's all ahead this morning, creatively speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.
With communities everywhere looking for ways to become greener, a new book digs into the history of Philadelphia's natural environment. When she moved from New England, Sharon White got to know her new city by researching and exploring gardens, both past and present. She chronicles this journey in her book, Vanished Gardens, Finding Nature in Philadelphia. How soon after you arrived in Philadelphia did this subject matter suggest itself?
Almost immediately, actually, because we had never owned a house before. We bought a house, and it was a house that was, I didn't have the experience of living in a house that had no front yard. It was right on the street, and so I decided to start writing about being in Philadelphia. And because I had quit my job, I wasn't immediately working, so I had this great time where I could just walk and write and look at things and listen. And the more that I wrote, the more that I realized I was actually writing about gardens. But that didn't happen until a couple of years after I had been here.
How different is Philadelphia in terms of all of these lost treasures? Because some people suggest that, of course, we lose gardens, we lose buildings. That's just the nature of development, or that's the way cities evolve. Is that the case in Philadelphia, or how is it different from other cities?
It was different for me because I had lived in Denver, which is a much newer city, and had lived outside of New York City, but didn't know the history of that city at all. But it turned out that I actually lived on top of a garden called the Labyrinthine Garden. And I didn't find that out until quite a while after I'd started writing. I also discovered that I was living on property that used to be William Penn's son, Thomas, and that it also was property that was part of the first section of Fairmont Park. And so for me, it was really unearthing all these layers. What's interesting, too, is when I started doing the research about this, a lot of this information wasn't on the web. You know, it wasn't, you couldn't just Google Lemon Hill and come up with something. So it was really fun to start discovering all the names of people and where the properties overlapped and how my house was in the middle of all this. So I think that's what made it different for me, because you're right, most cities have a history that hasn't been told.
You mentioned Lemon Hill as being somewhere where we can go and examine a house with surrounding property. The other obvious one, I guess, is Bartram's Garden, which has purposefully, because of the history of its owner, been preserved. Are there many other examples of historic gardens that we could actually go and see today?
Many of them, like Lemon Hill, isn't, obviously the actual gardens aren't there anymore. But I think in Philadelphia, of the places that I wrote about, Stenton is there. The house is there, but the garden is gone. Most of the places are not there. You know, there, Bartram's Garden is, in some ways, it's like what it was, but obviously it's
a very different setting.
Yeah, a very tiny piece of what was there. And as you said, it's surrounded by buildings and it's very different.
When you decided that it was going to be a book, did you have in mind who it was for? Is this for historians? Is this for gardeners? Is it especially for or only for people who live in Philadelphia?
It's for all those people. At least that's what I decided, because it's not only about Philadelphia. It's about seeing where you are, beginning to understand how the city is connected to the landscape around it, how there really is landscape in the city, that there really are animals. I think that that's really what the book was about for me.
Sharon White. Her latest book, Vanished Gardens, Finding Nature in Philadelphia, is published by the University of Georgia Press on Monday. The book is officially launched at an event at Bartram's Garden in West Philadelphia tomorrow afternoon at 1. Leonard Bernstein's famous overture to Candide has been so much a part of the musical landscape over the last 50 years, it's hard to imagine that the original 1956 Broadway show failed. Though Candide has met with success since then, the show hasn't just been the object of frequent revisions, but also a ready reflection of current events, as shown by a recent production scene in Paris, Milan, and London that turned the deposed kings of Act II into Tony Blair, George W. Bush, and other world leaders. The Arden Theatre is opting for the less provocative 1999 Royal National Theatre of Great Britain version, which may well be the best of all possible Candides, thanks partly to revisions by the show's original lyricist, poet Richard Wilbur, who spoke to the Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns for this report.
No Broadway show had such a meeting of remarkable talents as Candide. This musical adaptation of the Voltaire novella was written by Lillian Hellman, composed by Leonard Bernstein, directed by Tyrone Guthrie, and, years later, doctored by Stephen Sondheim and Harold Prince. All of them were in pursuit of a lighthearted manner with dead serious intent, its authors having survived conformist 1950s America and the career-destroying anti-communist witch hunts. Certainly, Candide is one of the few Broadway shows with an all-singing, all-dancing portrayal of the Spanish Inquisition. The Voltaire novella, which follows the innocent Candide and his high-born love Cunegonde as they're buffeted together and apart through several hemispheres by war and natural disasters, protested a huge range of social issues as well as the prevalent philosophy of optimism that accepts the worst inhumanities of war and devastating earthquakes as something right and good. Bernstein explained this in a 1989 concert recording.
And optimism, as a strict belief, therefore breeds complacency, induces lethargy, inhibits the human power to change, to progress, to rise against injustice, or to create anything that might contribute to a genuinely better world.
Though the concept was noble, the creation of Candide was often agonizing. There were some triumphant moments when this high-powered creative team worked brilliantly to solve problems and solve them quickly. One was the show's out-of-town tryout in Boston when, as lyricist Richard Wilbur recalls, Act Two needed a new song.
And I went home to my hotel room and started writing the number. Lenny and I completed that number by 3 o'clock in the morning. I managed to write the four parts for four voices of that number and get it over to Lenny's room, and he said, "I want this to be a very rousing number. I want it to sound like a carnival in Venice or the sort of song that a winning high school basketball team sings on the way back home in the bus."
That song became What's the Use, performed here at Paris's Châtelet Theatre as recorded by BBC Television.
It's a very fine thing to be prefect, shaking down all the gamblers in town. My position has only one defect, that there's someone who's shaking me down, who is shaking me down.
However, Wilbur recalls earlier work sessions on Martha's Vineyard when he and Bernstein sat together in a creative dead silence. The Wilbur was already an established poet and translator of Molière plays. Bernstein sometimes looked at the well-honed words and swore music wasn't possible. And when it was, Bernstein sometimes discovered that what he thought he'd written was unconsciously lifted from elsewhere. You know what they say, talent imitates, genius steals.
I remember driving back in the car from Lenny's house to my house on the Vineyard, and he turned on the car radio, and there was something of Saint-Saëns, I think. And he said, "Oh, my God, there it is. I've borrowed that, too. Isn't there anything new of mine in this show?"
Bernstein was wont to say that he only had 10 tunes in him, and one of them was a birthday song he'd written for his children that had to be drafted into service for Candide.
A da 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 da. That was also adapted for Lillian Hellman's birthday at one point. Something like three cheers for Madame Lillian. And at a certain point it seemed that we might use that music for the pilgrims to sing as they were heading off for the new world.
Though the brilliance of Candide was always recognized, the show is awfully highbrow for Broadway, and perhaps only the original cast album kept it from being forgotten. Later revisions either seemed too serious or, in the case of the mid-1970s Harold Prince Stephen Sondheim version, too light, too sexy. Not for another 15 years did Bernstein get around to assembling all the music he'd written for every version for a concert performance and studio recording with the London Symphony Orchestra and a cast of old friends such as Adolph Green and the distinguished art song interpreter Christa Ludwig. But Bernstein was ill, seemingly with the flu. During a conversation that I had with him at his noisy Savoy Hotel suite, with secretaries in the background and him plunking on piano, this lifelong smoker seemed to know something more was afoot.
Yeah. Somebody up there loves me. Somebody up there must love me an awful lot, because I shouldn't be around at all by this time, according to doctors, the wisest doctors. When I was in my late 20s, they told me that I had to stop smoking that minute or I'd be dead by 35. Yeah. And at 35, they told me 45, and so on. And they're all dead. New doctors have been telling me the same thing, and they're right. You know, I think it's caught up with me. I've gotten away with murder, this old age. I have reduced remarkably the amount of smoking. And I'm chewing this horrible substance called Nicorettes, full of nicotine. I was supposed to replace the nicotine supply in the blood, but they don't make up for that bliss of the glorious black lung inhalation.
Less than a year later, Leonard Bernstein was dead from a pleural tumor. And not for another decade did Candide have a serious, thoughtful revision, this time at the hands of Les Miserables collaborator John Caird. Wilbur, who had gone on to win the Pulitzer Prize and become Poet Laureate of the United States, was asked to sharpen What's the Use, inspiring some of the show's best lyrics, ones that are now heard in the Arden Theater production.
What's the use? What's the use? It affects me like rabies when men act like babies, pout, scream and shout.
Now, Wilbur is 87 and working on a new book of poems. The show's original star, Barbara Cook, is 80 and still performing. They're about the only two originals left.
I glimpse her sometimes on the television, but I think I haven't had an opportunity to say hello to her and express my gratitude.
What would you say to her if you could?
Well, I think I'd tell her the story about Tony Guthrie saying that she was going to wreck her voice. She's a girl, I think. She's got an untrained voice. She's going to ruin her voice if we have a long run. But she'll be good for the show. I think I'd congratulate her on still being in voice and having a happy following.
The Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns in the first of two reports on Leonard Bernstein's Candide. We'll hear part two next week. He writes about Candide in tomorrow's paper. The Arden Theatre in Philadelphia's production of the work opens on Wednesday. This month, the Walnut Street Theatre in Philadelphia opens its latest season with the Rodgers and Hammerstein musical State Fair. This marks a year when this national historic landmark will celebrate its 200th anniversary. The Walnut's storied past is matched by few American theatres, and as WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer reports, the company continues to grow.
Founded in 1809, the Walnut Street Theater is dubbed America's oldest theater. It's also one of the most active theaters around Philadelphia, with more than 20 productions and over 350,000 attendees each season. But the official state theater of Pennsylvania wasn't always a theater, at least not in the conventional sense.
It was an equestrian circus.
Bernard Havard, president and artistic director of the Walnut Street Theater, says two Frenchmen were behind the business enterprise, which featured riders on horses leaping through hoops of fire.
Riders jumping from one horse to another and with the ring. And it was popular, obviously, for 3 years. But basically, it started to wane. So they brought the actors in here in 1812.
That year, the building's first theatrical production, The Rivals, was staged with President Thomas Jefferson and the Marquis de Lafayette in attendance. Within 10 years, the structure was converted into a full-fledged theatrical stage and renamed the Walnut Street Theater. Beyond the distinction of being the oldest theater in America, the Walnut has many other claims to fame in its two-century history. Edwin Booth, the brother of Abraham Lincoln's assassin, co-owned the theater for a while. It was the first theater to install gas footlights in 1837. It was also the first theater to have air conditioning, consisting of ice blocks and fans. And the Walnut's managing director, Mark Sylvester, says it's believed that Edmund Kean, a 19th-century British actor, introduced the custom of the curtain call to America at the Walnut in the 1820s.
At the end of the performance, he came forward and took a bow, and the audiences and the management were very surprised by this new custom, and it caught on. And today you would never go to the theater and not see a curtain call.
In 1941, the Walnut Street Theater was purchased by the Schubert Organization, a company founded by a trio of brothers who owned and operated a large chain of theaters across the country. Under Schubert ownership, the Walnut became a venue for notable pre-Broadway tryouts and premieres, including A Raisin in the Sun, Porgy and Bess, and A Streetcar Named Desire. Managing director Mark Sylvester says in the late 1960s, the Schubert Organization, accused of being a monopoly, had to divest itself of some of its theaters.
And the Walnut was one. It wasn't seen viable with its size at that time, and it was scheduled for possible demolition. It seemed the only interest in the building was maybe to turn it into a parking lot. And the Haas Community Fund at that time purchased the theater and renovated it completely. And that was the point where the 1920s interior was modernized, which was the fashion in 1969.
The Walnut reopened as a performing arts center, presenting theater, opera, dance, music, and film. But throughout the subsequent decade, the theater was perpetually in financial trouble. Realizing something needed to change, the Walnut's board decided to create a nonprofit theater company, appointing Bernard Havard as the artistic director. Under Havard's tenure, the Walnut Street Theater has done well over the last 25 years. If having the largest subscription audience around is the measure, the company has over 56,000 season ticket holders. But even with large crowds and a rich, enviable history, the Walnut's success is accompanied by headaches. Though it's received numerous facelifts, the fact remains that it's an old theater. There's little or no insulation, for example, so heating and cooling the building is very expensive. And, Mark Sylvester says, it's a big house to fill.
Your average regional theaters in America range between 300 and 500 seats. We're more than double that. So the economics here of producing theater require that you do things on a large scale and that you play to a high capacity.
The Walnut makes no bones about it. It does populist theater. Crowd pleasers like Les Mis, 42nd Street, and The Producers. Bernard Havard says by necessity, audiences won't see many Shakespeare or Samuel Beckett plays at the Walnut. As long as the theater mainly relies on ticket sales for revenue, the company produces what it's confident it can sell.
What became obvious to us was every time this theater tried to become arty or appeal to the elitists in the city, it went to sheriff's sale. We have 200 years of history here. We can see what worked and what didn't work. And I can assure you, whenever this theater was not a populist theater, it failed. Every time, without exception.
The company's formula is hard to argue with, as its success puts it in a position to now expand. Within the next 2 years, the theater plans to break ground on an additional performance space to be built within a residential high-rise.
We have purchased the parking lots to the east of the theater, and our vision is to build a 400-seat theater in the round, another theater to complement what we already have.
From a circus ring in 1809 to a soon-to-be brand-new theater in the round, The Wall Street Theater has undergone a lot of change over the past 200 years. But as it enters into its third century, it continues to do what it was originally built to do, serve as a venue for live entertainment. And no other theater in the country has done it longer.
WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer. The Walnut Street Theatre officially celebrates its 200th anniversary on February 2nd. Its season opener, State Fair, runs through October 19th. And that's it for now. You can find an archive of past shows and subscribe to our podcast at WRTI.org. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly. Our executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Creatively Speaking is a production of WRTI in Philadelphia. Support for the program comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.